Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Good day, everybody. I'm David Marsh of Omfer. It's a great pleasure to have an hour-long conversation here now with Jim Bullard, a very familiar figure on the American and international economic stage, who's the president and CEO of the St. Louis Fed. He's been there since 2008, almost after Charlie Evans, the longest-serving member of the FOMC. And, of course, he's a bit of a lifer, having started at the St. Louis Fed more than 30 years ago. So he's very well known to comment on the ups and downs of the US and the international economy. We are in a very special state now, Jim, and so I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with you and then opening this up to the audience in about half an hour. I, like many, were listening to the absolutely inimitable Larry Summers yesterday, who was talking about what he called the, quote, serenity, end quotes, of the Fed faced with this enormous monetary and fiscal stimulus that we are seeing, and saying that it's impossible to believe that the Fed will just carry on now for 3 years in a very tidy way without raising interest rates sometime during that phase. So clearly, there's been a bit of concern about the blip in inflation that we saw last week. But first of all, perhaps you could just start off, Jim, just telling us what you think the outlook now is for the US economy in this year and next, both elements of your mandate. And then if there's time, I'm sure we'll go through the rather interesting elements of the international economy as well. But over to you, Jim, for your opening remarks on where are we in the US cycle?
Well, thanks, David. And it's a pleasure to be here and have a chance to chat again. I think one thing about being a Fed president is I only have to put out a forecast once a quarter, and so I don't have to do it every day. The last time we did this at St. Louis, we put down 6.5% real GDP growth for the U.S. in 2021, which all by itself would be astonishingly fast growth for an entire year for the U.S. economy. I think U.S. may grow faster than China, for instance, just to put it on the right scale. So you really got a big economic boom going on. I think some of that has been pulled up into the first half of 2021. That has surprised me a little bit, and I wouldn't want to commit too much here, but I think we'll review our forecast in June. I wouldn't be surprised if it gets marked up. At that point, Wall Street has marked up a lot of their forecast for all of 2021. And then in 2022, I think you'll still be growing well above trend in 2022. So there will be persistence here of this recovery and expansion of the U.S. economy. One of the things on GDP that I want to stress is that the U.S. in GDP terms is not in recession, nor is the U.S. even in recovery. You know, by traditional definitions, the U.S. is actually moving into expansion mode right now, this quarter or as we speak, and surpassing the previous peak in GDP and going beyond that. And not only that, but projections have U.S. GDP going above the trend line that you would have drawn pre-pandemic. So we've really got a lot of growth in the U.S. economy, a lot of output being produced, and a lot of income being earned. And that, I think, is something that is you know, some of Wall Street and global financial markets are now talking about mid-cycle. So you're actually past the recovery stage now. So I think that's hard for people to totally get their heads around. We can talk about that more as we go through this interview. And then on inflation, we are going to see higher inflation, I think above 2% for 2021. Again, in the last round, we put 2.5% for all of 2021. I'd want to see more inflation data before I change that forecast. The data is very noisy at this point, so it's hard to determine. But I do think that the inflation will persist in 2022, and will remain above 2% in 2022. And then after that, we'll gradually come down to 2% from the high side. So that will be consistent with our new framework where we're somewhat more relaxed than we would have been in the Greenspan era, more dependent on observing data, less preemptive than we would have been, less forecast-oriented than we would have been. And so that's going to allow inflation to come up above our 2% inflation target, which we haven't hit for a decade. And then it's going to allow us to have somewhat higher inflation for some time, and then we'll converge back down to 2% from the high side. So I think that's the plan that we have sketched out. You never know if this is actually going to work. And since the pandemic is such an unusual time with all this volatility in the data, way higher volatility than we're used to, it's hard to discern signal from noise. So we're all challenged by that. Traders are challenged by that, and central banks are challenged by that.
Well, everybody is challenged, but the point is that when you set out that new strategy last August, the world seemed to be in a different place and the US seemed to be in a different place. It would surely be quite admissible to say the world has moved on. There's a new president, a new program, a new bunch of people running things, a new fiscal program. I don't want to bang on too much about Larry Summers. I won't mention his name again, but there's only the one thing did strike me. He spoke about complacency and also said it would be quite okay to change your mind a bit about the 3 years. I mean, you say, Jim, that you're going to be relaxed. Are you serene? And also you say inflation is going to be a bit above 2% for some time. Do you not think there's a real danger that it could go quite a bit above 2% for quite a bit of time? And that would mean you'd actually have to reverse this idea of a serene future of very accommodative rates for the next 3 years. You might have to tear all that up and say, I'm sorry, we're now in a different playbook.
Well, we're certainly going to have to be nimble. And I think in any crisis management situation, you have to admit that you develop a plan one day and the crisis goes in a different direction the next day, and you have to react to that. So in that sense, I think we're completely ready to alter plans if necessary. But I don't think we're to that point yet. And I have argued against trying to do anything to change policy when we're still in the pandemic. We're not quite out of the woods on the pandemic, although you can make arguments about that now. You know, we don't have everybody vaccinated. It's not entirely clear what the virus variants are going to do. But the CDC did come out with, I think, a surprising change in guidance in the U.S. Last week, where they said that a person that's been vaccinated, fully vaccinated, does not have to socially distance and does not have to wear a mask. So I think that is going to change the dynamic and the tone of the discussion in the U.S. And I think it has macroeconomic consequences for how fast the U.S. economy can continue to reopen or make the last stages of reopening. Because what that's doing is, in my view, shifting the onus to the individual. Yes, we have a deadly disease circulating around, but we have a way to prevent that disease. And so it's up to you, and vaccines are widely available. So now it's up to the individual, if they're worried about it, to go get the protection that's available for free. And so it's not so much up to the public health authorities or public policy to prevent people from getting sick as it is up to the individuals. So that's a controversial thing, but I think it does have macro consequences. It will pull forward, I think, some of the macroeconomic expansion that otherwise would have been later in the year. And so we'll have to see how this plays out in coming days here.
Yes, we're getting some questions in quite early, so please do keep the questions coming. I just want to go into the labour market, Jim, because we've seen these two sets of figures going slightly in different directions. The unexpectedly strong inflation figures, and then what seemed to be some figures on the labour market showing what people seem to think was quite a bit of slack still in the labour market. You yourself have highlighted the very strong labour market figures, such as the unemployment to jobs vacancy numbers, for instance. Now, you said that ratio is at an all-time low. You seem to be saying that the labour market isn't as slack as many other people are thinking. Do you think there's a real danger of bottlenecks developing in certain key sectors which could actually push up the inflation rate over and above what you've been predicting up to now?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the labor market is tighter than is being represented. And so my argument is that the first of all, anecdotal reports, if you talk to companies, they all say it's very, very hard to hire in this environment. They've been very surprised. They always complain about hiring, but it's multiplied by 10 here. So they've had, in the past, they've had things that they would do. They'd have a job fair. They'd have, they'd put out advertisements in certain areas, and that would be enough to attract workers to their jobs. But that, none of that's working now. And so I think it's, it really is true that it's a tight labor market. And if you look at these, at this unemployment to vacancies ratio, which is what the academic literature would use to measure labor market tightness, that's a 1.2 in the U.S. That's almost as low as we've ever seen it. Not quite, as low as we've seen it, but, you know, around the, you know, the rate of one job opening per unemployed person. So, once people feel a little bit more comfortable going back to work or searching for a job, there are jobs out there. And so I'm hopeful and I think that they'll be able to find those jobs and get back to work when it's appropriate for their situation or for their family. So I do think that this now one of the key issues here is this labor force participation. So you had labor force participation, in my view, running somewhat above the downward trend line. It's, labor force participation has been trending down since the year 2000 in the U.S. If you draw a simple trend line, we were above the trend line in the last part of the expansion before the pandemic. And then the pandemic came along and you had marginally attached workers, especially those that were close to retirement. They went ahead and retired. They said, well, this is a, you know, this is a big hit here and I'm okay for retirement. So they just went ahead and retired and dropped out of the labor force. Now we're back on the trend line. So it's not clear to me that we should expect a lot more labor force participation to go back to 2017, 2018, 2019 levels, given that there's this downward trend and those retirees, you know, one thing about them is, asset markets are great. You know, equities are near an all-time high. Housing prices are very high. So their nest eggs are as good as they're going to be. And so you wouldn't expect them to want to come back into the labor market or not have very much of an urge to come back into the labor market.
But you might expect them to spend a lot of money on things which maybe the prices will go up. I mean, this, you're talking about supply-demand issue.
The story about jobs being way down from the pre-pandemic level, I think, is mixing up a little bit about what we think is going to happen with labor force participation. Now, you also have child care problems, you have, schools that, have not, you know, have been, done remotely, and then you've got to provide child care, and you've got another group of people that have dropped out because of that, and I'm hopeful that, they'll be able to get back in if they want to, because you do have a lot of job openings in this environment. So, we'll see how this goes. I'm not really expecting a million jobs a month. I don't know if we can really get that. I think it'd be more like 500,000 jobs per month in the near term here. So I think it's been a little bit hyped up on Wall Street that we'd get a million jobs a month.
Well, thank you for putting that into some perspective. And it is important given the two sides of your mandate. We've had quite a few questions already about the inequality. Given the fact that different sectors are advancing at different rates, how much judgment are you making, both as an FOMC member, but also as an academic, as a scholar, in looking at the sectoral differences in, say, labour activity? There is a lot of disparity between the different sectors at the moment because of the pandemic Is that a very important part of what you're looking at in terms of your barometer as a policymaker? And do you think we will see some sort of flattening of these disparities as we move further into the expansion phase?
Well, absolutely. We're very concerned about everyone in the economy, so we want everyone to do well. I think the description of this as a K-shaped event where the high-income workers were able to work from home or otherwise stay employed and the low-income workers got disrupted by the pandemic, I think that's very accurate. But I also think we had a brilliant fiscal policy in the U.S. Despite dysfunctional politics, we somehow came up with exactly the right strategy for a pandemic, which has this kind of disruption at the low end of the income scale. We said to people, if you're out in a high physical contact industry, you're going to have to stay home for a while we invest in public health. But don't worry, we're going to do our best to insure you so that you'll be able to pay your rent. You'll be able to pay for your normal lifestyle while we're waiting out the pandemic. And that has worked very well. If you look at personal income in the U.S., which is sort of what households actually get, including transfers, personal income is well above the trend line that you would have drawn from 2019. So in terms of aggregate resources, and it is unevenly distributed, I understand that, but in terms of aggregate resources, personal income is well above the trend line. And so we've done more than enough to keep households whole during this period. Now, I think the benefit of that is about to really be shown, because as we come out of the pandemic, what we have is a situation where we haven't done as much damage to the U.S. economy as we would have otherwise. And that's going to allow the expansion to be very, very strong. And in fact, as I was saying earlier, GDP is scheduled to go above the trend line that you would have drawn through 2018-2019 data. And gosh, that's a pretty good outcome. Not only do you come out of the pandemic looking better, but you're growing at a faster rate and have more output and more income than you would have had just following the pre-pandemic trend line, and no pandemic having occurred at all. So we are concerned about this, and we've put it in our new framework that I think we've always been concerned. We always care as macroeconomists. We care about everybody in the whole society. We want the best outcomes that we can get for everybody. But we are more explicit about this in our new framework to make sure that we're messaging correctly, that we really want everyone to succeed in the society.
Well, as you say, that does seem to be succeeding. You also now have a Treasury Secretary who seems to have a real social conscience, just as she did, of course, when she was the chair of the Federal Reserve. And you see that in the statements from the Treasury, just as you did see that various things Janet Yellen said when she was the chair. But all this seems to be pushing in the direction of a lot of money coming into the economy. You've got the forced savings, which you've spoken about recently. You've got the whole household policy, which means that people are still getting money coming in, even if they're not actually working. Doesn't that mean that there's a kind of tiger about to spring in terms of the first of all, the pent-up demand, and secondly, what monetarists would call a monetary overhang? I know nobody's really a monetarist these days, but you do have those quite alarming figures in M4. Milton Friedman, were he alive, would be purring very contentedly about the fact that people are at last starting to think about the money supply. Are you thinking about that, Jim?
Well, we're going to get out the Ouija board and see if we can contact.
Well, you can do that in St. Louis, maybe.
A former St. Louis Fed colleague of mine, Ed Nelson, has put out a 2-volume book on Milton Friedman, which I would recommend for those that are interested. A seminal work. I would have to say he's a leading scholar today working on Milton Friedman. And it's true that people have cited money numbers as evidence that inflation will go higher. I am cognizant and at heart I'm an inflation hawk, so I am cognizant that this process could get out of control. But when I look at the TIPS market as of today, the 5-year trading in maybe the 270 range. I haven't checked it today. And the 5-year forward trading somewhat lower than that. So that suggests that, yes, we'll get an inflationary impulse out of this, but then we'll converge to 2% from that higher level of inflation, and that'll be consistent with the new framework that we've outlined. And we can track in TIPS market, we can track day by day what the market judgment is. Given the latest information and given the twists and turns in the pandemic, we can judge, you know, we can look at the market judgment on, you know, are people really willing to put their money down that inflation's going to really get out of control to the high side? And maybe some people are, but the total market judgment seems to be very consistent with the plan that we're laying out here. So that gives me some confidence that at least as of today, we're on a good path, and hopefully we can navigate our way through this.
But you seem to be saying, Jim, that there is an inflation hawk in you, just kind of starting maybe a bit, about to leave.
There's an inflation hawk in all of us, including you, because we all came out of the Volcker era and we all saw the damage that could be done by very high and inflation, including the damage that could be done to the lower end of the income distribution. So it's not doing anybody any good to let inflation run out.
Well, I remember
we do want to hit the inflation target on average over time, and we haven't been able to do that because we didn't. Earlier in the 90s, we didn't take into account the zero lower bound. We didn't think that was a issue. Now we understand that it's an issue. So we're going to have to allow a little bit more inflation during this boom time than we otherwise would have.
I can see that, but I do remember at an earlier occasion, before your change in 2016 with your regime change, but you were talking very compellingly, I think, about what appeared to be a kind of group think that got into the FOMC during the Greenspan era, and you were actually raising interest rates too slowly during a period of time before the great financial crisis. It wouldn't take too much for us to get back to that feeling that maybe the Fed is being a bit complacent. I just wonder, when do you think in the next few months will we know more? I acknowledge everything you said about the uncertainty. We're coming out of a very difficult and dangerous, unprecedented phase. But things do seem to be going in the right direction. Vaccinations, the recovery picking up, also internationally with some brighter spots than others. Will we know more, would you say, by the late summer or the fall about where we are? And then you'll be able to tell the world that maybe Bullard have become, again, an inflation hawk.
I think later this summer, I think is probably a good target. Although I would caution everybody, you really have to take this day by day. And, where are we with respect to the pandemic? I mean, the CDC announcement seems to suggest that we're quite a ways, along. And we can, relax a lot of these restrictions, getting people back to work. A lot of this is just space restrictions and stuff that you can't, your physical space can't handle a lot of people if they all have to be 6 feet apart, which was the previous guidance. But now if that's being dropped, you may be able to move pretty quickly to reopen. And then it's, for the individuals involved, some of them may still be skittish, but gosh, there's a lot of vaccines out there. They can go get a vaccine if they're skittish about it. If they're not, they can take some risk, I guess, if they want. There's not going to be any mandate or anything like that. But that sounds to me like pandemic coming to a close. And if it does come to a close, then that will be a chance to recalibrate start thinking about recalibrating monetary policy appropriately. Given our new framework. So I haven't wanted to make changes while we're still in the pandemic tunnel, but we want to be nimble as we come out of the pandemic tunnel about how we're going to think about policy near term.
No, I get that. Linked to this, a question has come in from the audience, an inevitable question. With inflation increasing rapidly, even if it may be transitory, would this be an appropriate time to begin a conversation about your balance sheet, about the famous tapering or reducing the monthly purchases?
We're leaving that up to the chair as to when to open that discussion. And again, I'm advocating that we get more solid evidence that the pandemic is really behind us and is not going to have a stinger tail to it that that turns out to be a problem that extends for another 6 months or something or longer. So I think you don't want to start down a path of changing policy and then have to go back into emergency mode because the pandemic has gone in some direction that you didn't anticipate. So you really want to get this nailed down with respect to the public health. Then I think we can think about how to discuss things. But I will say this about the taper. When we actually did it, in December 2013, you might recall, David, that I dissented in June 2013 at the FOMC that day. But when we actually went about the actual taper and actually did it, it was a non-event. And that went on all through 2014 and all came to a close. So I actually think that we can replicate that when the time comes appropriately and we can get another non-event to be associated with this paper. So there's a lot of talk about it today, but I just remind everybody what actually happened at the end was a non-event.
Well, it was the talk about the taper, wasn't it, rather than the taper itself.
The other thing about June 2013, and let me just rant about this a little bit, the issue there in my mind is that the FOMC was coming in that day, downgrading the forecast. So we had a state contingent policy, and we said we were going to wait until things improved before we started to taper. But then we came in June, and we said we're going to downgrade our real GDP forecast. So we don't think things are going as well as we thought. But nevertheless, we're talking about withdrawing accommodation. That was the juxtaposition that didn't work at that point in time. And I don't think we're going to be in anything like that here. Here you've got an absolutely booming U.S. economy. And so I don't think we're going to be in the situation where we were in June 2013.
You mentioned, Jim, about the chair being the person, Jay Powell being the person who actually decide on this. Do you think he's also thinking like you that we've got a couple of months of uncertainty still to go, but the time to really make up one's mind will therefore be the summer? Do you think he would agree with that statement that we will see a bit more clarity about the balance sheet at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what he's going to do on this issue. I think he, just to be, he's said publicly he wants to wait and see the coming data and then make a decision. So let's just let him go down that path, see the data, and then construct a good path forward for the FOMC.
Right. Let's go on to the more international dimension here. I spoke earlier about the social conscience. You've spoken about the need for people in the United States to all rise up together. I mean, that's a very important part of the equation. Now, we do have an extraordinary situation. As you say, the U.S. may grow ahead of China this year. America, for all kinds of reasons, partly because you are America, you're expanding much faster than the rest of the world. Is there a danger in your mind that were there to be a tightening, nobody knows at the moment, were there to be a tightening ahead of your schedule, which had been sketched out for 3 years of smoothness, but were that to happen, that could really come at a very, very bad time for the world economy, not least for the emerging market economies. Is that in any way part of your thinking when you do get to that moment of truth, perhaps in a couple of months?
Yeah, this has been a sort of perennial issue for the committee. And, of course, we also want, the global economy to do well because that's good for the U.S. economy. So I do think we have to take on board international considerations, when we're making, policy in the U.S. But I think the issue there is more about surprise. Would we make a surprise move that knocks global markets out of sync and leads to a lot of capital flows that are very hard to handle in smaller economies. So that I don't think will happen. I think we'll be very intentional and do the best we can to signal where we're going. But we also have to react to data, so we do have to sometimes deviate some from what we previously said, but we'll do the best we can to communicate how those decisions will be made, and that would, in my mind, lead to a smooth transition with the U.S. as an engine of global growth. I'm a little bit encouraged by Europe. Europe's looking better, I think, for the second half of 2021. And together, we can help the rest of the global economy come along as they get vaccinated and put their pandemic worries behind them.
Yes, we're getting quite a number of questions in now, but do keep them coming. I'm going to go back onto the inflation question in just one second, but you spoke about the rest of the world here. You spoke about Europe. I mean, Europe is very patchy. Where do you see in the emerging markets, where do you see the problems? You spoke about small economies, but of course there's some quite large economies that seem to be in some difficulties at the moment. Where do you see the pressure spots around the world, particularly in the emerging market economies, where you might think that these people could be very vulnerable were there to be, for instance, a too sharp increase in the U.S. interest rates? Where would that do the most damage?
Well, I'm a little concerned on the pandemic itself. So for those of you that follow me, thank you. And I've been saying that, the fatalities per day per million in North America and Europe have been something that I've been tracking to try to track the pandemic. But if you look at the same measure in Asia, it's an order of magnitude lower across Asia. And, only now are you seeing India kind of come up off zero on that kind of scale. This is fatalities per day per million, kind of the run rate of the pandemic. And I thought earlier in the pandemic, I thought, well, there must be some kind of natural immunity in Asia, so this pandemic isn't hitting them as hard. But now I'm a little worried that you've got vulnerable populations in Asia that haven't yet experienced the pandemic, and that maybe that's what you're seeing in India. And I think it has peaked a little bit in India. But so that makes me think that the pandemic could have a while to run in some parts of the world if we can't get vaccinations out to all these countries appropriately. So that's making me wonder about my previous ideas. I thought Asia had some natural immunity. North America and Europe were going to get vaccinated. Then you'd come out of the pandemic that way. But maybe it's not going to evolve quite that way. It'd be U.S., Europe get vaccinated. Asia is still vulnerable, has more problems that linger for longer, and then global growth does not go quite as well as it was in my head, previously. So I'm a little worried about that scenario, given the data out of India. It is a big economy and continues to be one of the leaders in global growth.
Do you think, not as a policymaker, but just as a concerned citizen, that the United States should actually be still more generous and not just relieve the patent rights, but actually just grant big gifts of vaccines and medicines to countries like India to try to alleviate those pressures that you're talking about?
I think we are going to see vaccines going across borders. We're already seeing some of that, and I'm sure we'll see much more of that going forward. I would be very careful about protecting the intellectual property of the companies that develop these vaccines. This is an astonishing story that this pandemic came along. We had a vaccine strategy. I myself was skeptical of this strategy because people said, well, the fastest we've ever done any of this is 4 years. So I was kind of skeptical that we could do it. But lo and behold, we got to late 2020. This is only about 6 or 8 months into the pandemic, and we had vaccines ready to go. And not only that, we got them up and produced. So that's a fantastic story, but you don't want to then bang the pharmaceutical companies over the head and say, oh, we're going to take all this away from you, because then the next time the pandemic comes along or some other big health problem, you know, they'll wonder if they should do anything or not, because they're going to end up spending a lot of resources that they can't recoup. So this is a very touchy issue. But I think this can be resolved in other ways, where the U.S. and other countries can help countries around the world with vaccine exports.
Yeah, well, thank you for those very carefully balanced comments. Maybe something that you really think is a good idea will almost by definition not have a very good chance of getting past Congress. One could draw that conclusion. But thank you very much indeed, Jim, for being so open and friendly and generous with your time. And we look forward to seeing you again in the flesh as well as virtually.
If you found this podcast interesting, why not attend our Fed Week from 21st to 25th of June in partnership with the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia? Over 5 days, Fed Week will cover topics from the economics of artificial intelligence, a green recovery, central bank digital currency, financial stability, macroeconomic developments, and how all of this is feeding into the decisions the Fed is making. Speakers include the presidents of the St. Louis, Boston, Atlanta, Dallas, and Philadelphia Federal Reserve Banks, alongside participants from the Board of Governors and New York Fed. To register, please click the link below in the show notes or visit our website, www.omfif.org/fedweek.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.